Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 1 Kings chapter 3. I'm going to do verses 1 through 28, the entire chapter. I'm going to call this chapter Solomon's Wisdom. Our context is this. In the last chapter of 1 Kings chapter 2, we saw David's dying instructions to Solomon, in which he basically tells Solomon to kill some of David's political enemies that he wasn't able to get rid of during David's reign. And then we see Adonijah's foolish request, the failed claimant to the throne, Solomon's half-brother. He asked for Abishag the Shunammite, who used to belong to David, and that made Solomon execute him for being so uppity, because having a king's former, she wasn't really a concubine, but she belonged to David, and that seemed that that was a claim on the throne. Solomon got rid of him, then he banished Abiathar, the priest of David that had gone with Adonijah during Adonijah's rebellion, then he executed Joab like David wanted him to. So basically the last chapter was all about Solomon getting rid of his enemies. So his throne is firmly established, as the last verse of that chapter says, and so now we are prepared to embark upon the first accounts of his kingdom. So we start now in 1 Kings chapter 3, verses 1 through 3. Solomon made an alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married his daughter. He brought her to the city of David until he finished building his palace and the temple of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. The people, however, were still sacrificing at the high places because a temple had not yet been built for the name of the Lord. Solomon showed his love for the Lord by walking according to the statutes of his father David, except that he offered sacrifices and burned incense on the high places. Now, Pharaoh, king of Egypt. This is the first time a pharaoh has been mentioned from the time of Moses at the Exodus, which was a long time ago, about 400 years ago. Until this time, that seems sort of strange because Egypt is a potent kingdom and it resides right next to Israel. However, it should be noted that Egypt right now at this period of time is governed by a race of kings of whom there is nothing worthy to relate. And as we're going to find out later, Solomon ends up being the big shot in the ancient Near East because Assyria is down, Babylon is not anywhere, and Egypt is down too. But we do see the Pharaoh mentioned here. Solomon marries his daughter. Now the question arises, is this a wise thing for Solomon to do? Now Adam Clark doesn't think so. Let me quote from him. But should political considerations prevail over express laws of God? God had strictly forbidden his people to form alliances with heathenish women, lest they should lead their hearts away from him into idolatry. Let us hear the law. Now Clark quotes Exodus 34:16, Neither shalt thou make marriages with them. Thy daughter thou shalt not give unto his son, nor his daughter shalt thou take unto thy son, for they will turn away thy son from following me. Clark also quotes Deuteronomy 7:3-4, which says the same thing. Now Solomon, Clark continues, acted in direct opposition to these laws, and perhaps in this alliance were sown those seeds of apostasy from God and goodness in which he so long lived and in which he so awfully died. Well, that sounds pretty damning. Let me read another quote from Clark. That Solomon is most expressly reproved in Scripture for this very match is to me very evident from the following passages. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations was there no king like him who was beloved of his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, even him did outlandish, that means foreign women, cause to sin. Nehemiah 13:26. So Clark quotes Nehemiah 13:26 and says that that passage is referring to this marriage of the Pharaoh's daughter. Clark continues, Now it is certain that Pharaoh's daughter was an outlandish, that means foreign woman, and although it is not expressly said that Pharaoh's daughter is here intended, yet there is all reasonable evidence that she is included, and indeed the words seem to intimate that she is especially referred to. In 1 Kings 3:3, that's our verse here, it is said, Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of David. And Nehemiah says, Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things, who was beloved by his God? Referring most probably to this early part of Solomon's history. So the phrasing is somewhat similar there, between 1 Kings 3:3 and Nehemiah 13:26. But supposing that this is not sufficient evidence that this match is spoken against in Scripture, let us turn to 1 Kings 11, verses 1 and 2, where the cause of Solomon's apostasy is assigned, and where we read, "But King Solomon loved many strange women, together with the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, and Zidonians, and Hittites, of the nations which the Lord said unto the children of Israel, You shall not go into them, neither shall they come unto you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon clave unto those in love." Now, this is a fairly strong argument here, because the daughter of Pharaoh is mentioned in with all these other heathen women that caused Solomon's heart to turn around. Clark continues, "Here the marriage with Pharaoh's daughter is classed most positively with the most exceptional of his matrimonial and concubinal alliances, and as it is no doubt had its predisposing share in an apostasy the most unprecedented and disgraceful." Well, I think Clark makes a very strong argument that this Pharaoh's daughter was the beginning of Solomon's downfall. It's always a woman, except in Solomon's case, it's always 1,000 women. Now, this daughter of Pharaoh that Solomon is said to marry in verse 1 was very probably a proselyte first to the Jewish religion. That's what John Gill says. Adam Clark doesn't believe that. Gill's argument is it could hardly be thought that Solomon would marry a pagan Egyptian without her first converting to Judaism. Gill also says that there's no evidence that she seduced him to Egyptian idolatry. Now, of course, this is directly opposed to what Clark just said, and I would say that Clark has got a good argument there that there is evidence that the daughter of Pharaoh seduced Solomon to Egyptian idolatry. But Gill goes on to say that the 45th Psalm was supposedly written on the occasion of this marriage. That psalm has a title in the Holman Christian Study Bible as, quote, "a royal wedding song," and of course it doesn't mention anything about idolatry. Some people say that the Song of Solomon is supposed to have been written on this occasion of his marriage to the Egyptian daughter, and that the Shulamite woman mentioned in the Song of Solomon is the same daughter of Pharaoh. But as gotquestions.org says, there is no evidence supporting this theory in the Song of Solomon. Gill goes on to say, "Of all the idols that Solomon's wives drew him into the worship of, no mention is ever made of any Egyptian deities." Well, so there is a chance that Clark could be wrong about this daughter of Pharaoh being the one who seduced Solomon into idolatry, but it really doesn't matter too much because we know that the women eventually seduced him away from the love of the Lord. Whether it was this woman, this wife, or another wife, it doesn't really matter. Now, Solomon did have another wife. This Pharaoh's daughter was not his first wife. He was married to Naamah the Ammonitess before he was king, because he had had Rehoboam by Naamah a year before this. Now, verse 1 says that Solomon brought the daughter of Pharaoh to the city of David. Now, that's the same thing as Mount Zion. Now, Mount Zion has got to be one of the most confusing terms I've ever encountered. It's taken me 20 years to learn exactly what it means. Well, here's how it works. Zion was used as a synecdoche, a poetic reference to all of Israel or all of Jerusalem. That's Zion, without the mountain in front of it. But if you say Mount Zion, that could either refer to the city of David, or it could refer to Mount Moriah, which is northwest of the city of David. City of David being that long tongue of land surrounded by two valleys, Tyropian Valley on the west and the Kidron Valley on the east, and at the south, the Valley of Hinnom. And as I said, this is in the Old Testament scriptures. Mount Zion can refer to either of two places, the city of David, that long peninsula of land, or that flat area where the temple was eventually built on the top of Mount Moriah, right to the northwest of the city of David. So Zion is a little bit ambiguous. It could either mean city of David or it could mean Mount Moriah. I'm not sure if it could mean both of them at the same time. I wouldn't be surprised if it could be, but I don't know from my sources whether that's true. And this is also complicated more by the fact that in the Middle Ages, people got screwed up about what Zion referred to, and they thought it referred to the southwest of the city, which is nowhere near the places I just mentioned. So anyway, she's brought to the city of David. Now, verse 2 states that the people, however, were still sacrificing at the high places. Of course, back then, idolaters as well as Jews did their sacrificing on high places, because if you're up high in the air, you're closer to God. Now, this, of course, in verse 2 and 3, shows that the author of Kings was not happy about this, because The author of 1 Kings 3, verse 3 says, Solomon showed his love for the Lord by walking according to the statutes of his father David, except that he offered sacrifices on the high places. So it's very clear that Solomon is not doing what God wants. Now, this issue is a little bit complicated because of various laws in the Old Testament law. As the commentator Benson says, in general, sacrificing on high places was expressly forbidden by God to his people. Now, there's some exceptions to that. Benson just says in some extraordinary cases, but let's go into more detail than that. First of all, on the Exodus, before the temple was built, of course, they're in the desert carrying the tabernacle around. We read in Exodus 20:24, God tells Moses, you must make an earthen altar for me and sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, your sheep and goats, as well as your cattle. I will come to you and bless you in every place where I cause my name to be remembered. Well, obviously, that's not just one place to have an altar. That's on the Exodus, wherever Moses makes an altar, an earthen altar. Well, that was on the Exodus, but now that law was superseded by two laws that say the same thing in Leviticus 17 and Deuteronomy 12. These two scriptures, which I'll read you in a minute, they were meant to apply after the entrance into Canaan, after the Exodus was over. No more earthen altars just to be built on the way. But once you get into Canaan, God wants a permanent place for the sacrifices to be held. So let me read you those two scriptures. Leviticus 17, verses 3 through 5. Anyone from the house of Israel who slaughters an ox, sheep, or goat in the camp, or slaughters it outside the camp, instead of bringing it to the entrance to the tent of meeting to present it as an offering to the Lord before his tabernacle, that person will be considered guilty. He has shed blood and must be cut off from his people. This is so the Israelites will bring to the Lord the sacrifices they have been offering in the open country. They are to bring them to the priest at the entrance to the tent of meeting and offer them as fellowship sacrifices to the Lord. All right, that law right there says you got to sacrifice in front of the tabernacle, wherever that might be. And I assume that law superseded Exodus 20:24, where God tells Moses to make an earthen altar for him wherever he goes. No, I shouldn't have said that. It actually is saying that wherever the tabernacle goes, I want a sacrifice to be done on the bronze altar there at the tabernacle. Of course, the tabernacle is going to be moving around the wilderness, and so there's not one place for sacrifice. But now, in Deuteronomy 12, 10 through 14, we read this, when you cross the Jordan and live in the land of the Lord your God has given you to inherit, and he gives you rest from all the enemies around you, and you live in security, then Yahweh your God will choose the place to have his name dwell. Bring there everything I command you, your burnt offerings, sacrifices, offerings of the tenth, personal contributions, and all your choice offerings you vow to the Lord. You will rejoice before the Lord your God, you, your sons and daughters, your male and female slaves, and the Levite who is within your gates. Be careful not to offer your burnt offerings in all the sacred places you see. And that's the key verse right there. You don't offer your burnt offerings in all the sacred places. That means the high places where offerings were usually done. Don't do that. Verse 14, Deuteronomy 12. You must offer your burnt offerings only in the place the Lord chooses in one of your tribes. And there you must do everything I command you. Well, that would be in Jerusalem at the temple when it's finally built. Of course, it's not built yet. Solomon hasn't built that temple. And so the people are sacrificing at the high places, but not at the temple. Now, we've got to make some more exceptions here. In that period of time between the Exodus and the building of the temple, of course, Israel moved the ark around, moved the tabernacle around. And in fact, Jerusalem hadn't even been taken over by the Israelites until David got it. So during the time of the judges, the ark was moved around. The tabernacle was moved around, and so a lot of times it was not accessible for offering sacrifices. And so, as the Cambridge commentator says, the two scriptures I just read, Leviticus 17 and Deuteronomy 12, was talking about after entrance into Canaan land. You're supposed to do it at one place in Deuteronomy 12 and Leviticus 17 in front of the tabernacle. In other words, the tabernacle is supposed to be set in one place, and then you're going to sacrifice at that tabernacle. But since that one place was not readily available for a while, there were some exceptions, and Cambridge mentions some exceptions. Gideon, the famous judge at Ophrah, the town of Ophrah, he sacrificed. Manoah, Samson's father, sacrificed at Zorah. Samuel sacrificed at Zuph, and as the Cambridge commentator says, many other instances in the books of Samuel are given where there were sacrifices given to God, and there's no expression anywhere of God's disapproval. But now in Kings, there is disapproval. Why? Because Jerusalem has been fixed as the place of worship. Since Solomon's not doing a good thing until he builds the temple. Now, here's a question. Why did Solomon allow this exception to his integrity? He's following God in everything but this. Benson, the commentator, says this. Perhaps Solomon thought it was better to sacrifice in the wrong place than to allow the worship of Yahweh to collapse completely. In other words, it's a matter of expediency, not high-handed, premeditated rebellion against God. I suspect that's what it was. However, Benson points out, this expediency should have yielded to the law of God. He should have not done it. And you know, Gibeon, where the tabernacle was, they could have sacrificed there. That would have been perfectly legal. Why couldn't he just sacrifice there? But no, he let the people sacrifice all in the high places. And Solomon himself offered sacrifices and burned incense on the high places, not at Gibeon, like he should have. Well, I guess nobody's perfect. We go now to 1 Kings 3, verses 4 through 9. The king went to Gibeon to offer sacrifices, for that was the most important high place. And Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. Now, these offerings were offered in a legal place, as the Cambridge commentary points out. And Solomon offers 1,000 burnt offerings on the altar there? Well, that's a prodigious number, 1,000. Never before or ever since. After that, has there ever been known a sacrifice of that magnitude, except perhaps at the dedication of Solomon's temple, which we'll get to in a future podcast. Now, 1,000 burnt offerings, this must show that Solomon was rich from the get-go. He made a bunch of money with trade, as we'll see. He spent it in devotion to the Lord. And in fact, this extreme show of devotion may have prompted the dream from the Lord that Gideon received. And so let's look at that dream, starting with verse 5, 1 Kings 3. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon during the night in a dream, and God said, "Ask for whatever you want me to give you." Solomon answered, "You have shown great kindness to your servant, my father David, because he was faithful to you and righteous and upright in heart. You have continued this great kindness to him and have given him a son to sit on his throne this very day. Now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of my father David, but I am only a little child and do not know how to carry out my duties. Your servant is here among the people you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to count or number. So give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. For who is able to govern this great people of yours?" Solomon appears. In verse 5, the Lord appears to Solomon. How did Yahweh appear to Solomon in that dream? Perhaps he appeared as Jesus, an epiphany in a dream, so to speak. Maybe he appeared as a disembodied voice. I don't know. But somehow, Solomon is confronted with God. God says, "Whatever you want," and again, it could be because Solomon shows a very humble attitude here. As we'll see, he's already offered 1,000 oxen to the Lord, or 1,000 animals to the Lord. And Solomon starts his request by saying, "God, you've shown such kindness to my father David because he was righteous." And the righteous, that means he wanted to follow God. It doesn't mean that he was perfect. After all, he was an adulterous murderer. But he asked forgiveness. He was cleansed of the sin, Psalm 51. So he was a righteous guy and upright in heart. He followed Yahweh and not the idols. And then Solomon refers to the famous prophecy that Nathan had given to David. Solomon tells God, "You have given David a son to sit on his throne this very day." He's probably referring to Nathan's prophecy that there would always be a descendant of David on the throne. And then he very humbly says in verse 7, "I'm just a little child." Now, it's interesting that Solomon's opinion of himself was so different than his contemporaries, all of whom thought he was very wise. Well, maybe he got that reputation later. Right now, he's only about 20 years old. Most all the commentators say he was 19 or 20 when he took over the throne, and so he was like a little child. He wasn't a literal little child, but as far as governing, he was a babe in the woods. And he talks about how hard it is to govern a people, and it is. And so that's what he asked for. He wants wisdom. Now, he didn't ask for wisdom in general, but he asked for the wisdom to understand the true science of government. Solomon's prayer was obviously answered. He wrote lots of wisdom literature, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. And in that wisdom literature, of course, there's wisdom about how to be a good governor, good king. But he also got wisdom in general, even though he asked specifically for wisdom on how to govern. We go now to 1 Kings 3, verses 10 through 15. The Lord was pleased that Solomon had asked for this. So God said to him, "Since you have asked for this, and not for long life or wealth for yourself, nor have asked for the death of your enemies, but for discernment in administering justice, I will do what you have asked. I will give you a wise and discerning heart, so that there will never have been anyone like you, nor will there ever be. Moreover, I will give you what you have not asked for, both riches and honor, so that in your lifetime you will have no equal among kings. And if you walk in my ways and obey my statutes and commands as David your father did, I will give you a long life." Then Solomon awoke, and he realized it had been a dream. He returned to Jerusalem, stood before the Ark of the Lord's Covenant, and sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings. Then he gave a feast for all his court. In verse 10, we see that the Lord was pleased that Solomon had asked for something that was not directly related to his private interest. He was concerned for the people and not for him. He said that he's going to answer that prayer. God said that. And he said that there will never be anybody like you, Solomon. And there never has been anybody like you. Now, if you want to get literal about that, you end up with problems. It could be that you could say that there had never been a king in Israel that was as wise as Solomon, or would be like Solomon, either before or after, which means Solomon would be greater than Saul, obviously, but even greater than David. And that's probably true, but that's not exactly what God said. He didn't say never in the kingdom of Israel be anyone like you, never has been. He just said never, ever, period, absolutely. So that would make it refer to there has never been anyone like Solomon since the beginning of mankind, or through the future. Well, John Gill says, well, that would include Adam, because he's in his unfallen state. He was wiser than anyone. How about the apostles of Christ or Jesus? Well, the answer to this is that this is a Hebrew idiom. It's not meant to be taken literally. There's never been anybody like you, Solomon, and there never will be. I'll give you a classic example of that Hebrew usage. In the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24:21, we read this: "For at that time there will be great tribulation, the kind that hasn't taken place from the beginning of the world until now and never will again." Well, the great tribulation there, of course, is the run-up to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. I say that because I'm an Orthodox preterist. I realize there'll be a lot of futurists who will take it to be a great tribulation when the Antichrist takes over the world and all that Hal Lindsey, Tim LaHaye stuff. It doesn't matter. Whatever position you take on what the Great Tribulation is, can you say that there never has been a tribulation that great? What about Noah's flood? That was the worst tribulation of all times. The whole world was wiped out. So it's a Hebrew idiom. It just means, Solomon, you're really going to be wise. We see this in 1 Kings 4, 30 through 31. Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than all men. Then Ethan the Ezrahite, Heman, Chalcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahal, who obviously must have been some well-known wise men at the time. Solomon's fame was known in all the surrounding nations. So that prayer was answered by God. Now, in verse 12, God says, "There never has been anyone like you, nor will there ever be." It doesn't say like you in wisdom, but I think that's what's meant. It's implied. Notice that Solomon got what he didn't ask for. He was able to get more than he was able to ask or think. I think it's in Ephesians that Paul says that, Ephesians 2, if I remember correctly. More than he asked or think. Riches and honor. And what a great application of this. Ask for prayers that will help other people out, and God will take care of you. So after God says, "I'm going to add riches and honor to you, wisdom, so that in your lifetime you will have no equal among kings," that, of course, is literally true. He was the big dog in the ancient Near East. Some people have pointed out that beyond Solomon's lifetime, there might have been some that were richer. Alexander the Great probably was. Croesus, richest Croesus, the king of Lydia, Western Asia Minor, 6th century B.C., he was probably richer than Solomon. But nobody combined Solomon's wisdom and riches at the same time. And you can put that in the bank. No ancient king was wise and rich as Solomon. Where did Solomon get his riches? He came from foreign trade, and also surrounding countries like the Ammonites and Moabites giving him tribute. Now, in verse 14, God tells Solomon in his dream, "If you walk in my ways and obey my statutes and commands as David your father did, I will give you a long life." Well, did Solomon have a long life? Actually, no, he didn't. He had a long reign. He reigned 40 years, as John Gill, well, the scripture says that, and Albert Barnes says that he was about 19 or 20 at his accession, and that's well accepted. You can guess at it by seeing when he was born by Bathsheba, or speculating when David married Bathsheba. So he's about 20 at his accession. That makes him about 59 or 60 at his death, as Barnes says, and 60 is not very old. Ellicott said his life could hardly have exceeded 60 years old. That's not a long life. That's 10 years younger than me. Well, how do we explain that? Well, it's very easy. Look at verse 14. You see that the promise of a long life was conditional. If you walk in my ways and obey my statutes and commands, I will give you a long life. Did Solomon do that? No, he did not, as Barnes and Ellicott point out, and that explains his short life. We go now to 1 Kings 3, 16 through 22. Now, two prostitutes came to the king and stood before him. Now, what we're doing here, we're going to see an example of Solomon's wisdom. That's why the story is put here, because Solomon has just been promised wisdom, and now the author of Kings, probably Jeremiah, is now telling us, giving us an example of Solomon's wisdom. So starting over again at verse 16, 1 Kings 3, "Now two prostitutes came to the king and stood before him. One of them said, 'My lord, this woman and I live in the same house. I had a baby while she was there with me. The third day after my child was born, this woman also had a baby. We were alone. There was no one in the house but the two of us. During the night, this woman's son died because she lay on him. So she got up in the middle of the night and took my son from my side while I, your servant, was asleep. She put him by her breast and put her dead son by my breast. The next morning, I got up to nurse my son, and he was dead. But when I looked at him closely in the morning light, I saw that it wasn't the son I had born. The other woman said, 'No, the living one is my son, the dead one is yours.' But the first one insisted, 'No, the dead one is yours, the living one is mine.' And so they argued before the king." Now, these two women, were they prostitutes? Almost every translation I looked at said they were prostitutes. There's an argument against them being prostitutes. As Adam Clark says, the word zonoth, which we have here and in some other places, improperly translate harlots. The Benson commentary says the Hebrew word is ambiguous. It could either mean harlots or it could mean tavern keepers. Clark goes on to say that the Chaldee, comparing with the Chaldee, which is the best judge in this case, the word should be rendered tavern keepers. Clark goes on to say, if these had been harlots, it is not likely they would have dared to appear before Solomon. And if they had been common women, it is not likely they would have had children. In other words, prostitutes don't often have children, in other words. I don't know why. Nor is it likely that such persons would have been permitted under the reign of David. Though there is no mention of their husbands, it is probable they might have been at this time in other parts, following their necessary occupations. No, I don't think so. And the settling of the present business could not have been delayed till their return. The appeal to justice must be made immediately. Well, look at all the suppositions there. They got husbands. They're on the way back. The wives can't wait for the husbands to get back. They got to have justice now. I don't think so. Here are certain facts that indicate that these two women were prostitutes, and that's why this is the proper translation. First of all, there's no mention being made of their husbands. The second reason is they were living together in one house. If they were married, why would they be living together in the same house? And also, if you're a prostitute, you're probably stupid enough to brawl over whose child it was. It sounds like something a prostitute would do. And most of the translations say harlot, so I think Clark's wrong here. But we do need to point out it might not be prostitutes. It doesn't really matter whether they were prostitutes or not. Living in the same house shows that they were probably unmarried, and that's why they were before the king without their husbands, worrying about their child. Now, the babies were born 3 days apart. The honest prostitute had her child, and the dishonest prostitute had a child 3 days later. So they were so close in age, you could distinguish them by looking at them. They were probably, of course, they were the same sex. They were both sons. And you'll notice in this little scene that neither one of the women offered any proof as to which baby was whose. This is a difficult case that Solomon's got. The facts are such that it's hard to judge, because there were no facts, really. Now, we're going to look a little closer here as to why the dishonest prostitute stole the honest prostitute's live baby. Did she love that baby, just wanted to have a child, and was so grief-stricken because she lost her child? Or was it rather she was afraid she would be punished for lying on her baby and killing it? Or maybe, if not punished, at least disgraced? What kind of a mother are you? You just killed your own son. Now, the honest prostitute says that while she was asleep, the dishonest prostitute stole her baby. That's in verse 20. Well, now, how does she know, the honest prostitute, that the dishonest prostitute stole the baby? She was asleep. Well, I think it's a reasonable conjecture for the honest prostitute to make. There's nobody else in the house. It says that in verse 18, there was no one in the house but the two of us. So who's the finger of guilt going to be pointed at? Who else would have stolen the baby? Not to mention the fact that she could go over there and look at the baby that the dishonest prostitute had and says, whoa, that's my baby. A mother's going to recognize her baby. So the fact that she was asleep doesn't hinder her testimony at all. And now notice, Solomon has got to decide this case and doesn't have any facts. There's no way to distinguish the babies. The women are not offering any kind of proof that the live baby was one or the other woman's. Now, I know if I'd have had that case, I'd have probably thrown my hands up. I don't know what I would have done. But this is what Solomon did. 1 Kings 3, verses 23 through 28, and we'll finish this chapter. The king said, this one says, my son is alive and your son is dead. Well, that one says, no, your son is dead and mine is alive. What Solomon is doing there is saying, I don't have any proof. These women are just making claims. There's no proof. So, verse 24, then the king said, Solomon said, bring me a sword. So they brought a sword for the king. He then gave an order, cut the living child in two and give half to one and half to the other. The woman whose son was alive was filled with compassion for her son and said to the king, please, my lord, give her the living baby. Don't kill him. That's the honest prostitute, the one who was stolen from. But the other said, the dishonest prostitute said, neither I nor you shall have him. Cut him in two. Then the king gave his ruling, give the living baby to the first woman, the honest prostitute. Do not kill him. She is his mother. When all Israel heard the verdict the king had given, they held the king in awe because they saw that he had wisdom from God to administer justice. Now, in verse 25, when Solomon said, cut the living child in two, he didn't intend for the order to be carried out. He intended to happen what did happen, that the true mother would say, no, don't do it, because he figured the true mother would have more compassion for the baby. Now, the dishonest prostitute who had stolen the baby, she immediately says, cut him in two, I don't care. Well, now, if she was so willing to let the baby go now, why did she want to have him in the first place? Well, here's some suggestions to answer that. When Solomon issued his order to cut the baby in two, the dishonest prostitute knew that the baby was lost to her. She's never going to get it. So she says, okay, well, if I can't have the baby, the true mother, the honest prostitute, she can't have the baby either. And that way she could get revenge on the real mother for dragging her to court. That's reasonable. It could be that she had no affection for the baby, nor desire to have it, but of course that doesn't answer the question why she wanted to have the baby in the first place. But maybe the reason that she wanted to have this baby is not for love of the baby, but it was because she was afraid she would be punished, or because she would be shamed, and that punishment and shame is avoided when the baby's cut in two. Another speculation is maybe she wanted to be clear of the expense of keeping and nursing that baby. Ah, two babies too expensive to nurse. Too much trouble to raise the kid. Cut him in half, Solomon. Well, again, why would she undertake the expense of taking care of the baby by stealing the baby in the first place? So I think to summarize this, we can say that she stole that baby not because she... Well, there's several possibilities. One possibility, she really wanted to have a baby. She lost her baby and she wanted to raise a baby. A lot of women are like that, and so she stole the baby. And then when she realized that the baby was going to die when Solomon cut it in half, she says, well, I've lost the baby, I'm going to take revenge. That's one possibility. The other possibility is she didn't love the baby from the get-go. She was just taking the baby to avoid getting punished or being shamed. And so that's why she didn't care if Solomon cut the baby. Those are really your two options there. But at any rate, whatever the woman was thinking, her crying out, cut him in two, gave Solomon the clue as to who was going to win the case. And the honest prostitute won it. And as a result, everybody held Solomon in awe, as verse 28 says. They said his wisdom came from God to administer justice. And this just shows that there's nothing more valued in the Old Testament than an honest court system. And people hate lawyers. I understand that. I used to be a lawyer, too, and I understand why people hate lawyers. But if you don't have an honest justice system, you don't have anything. You need honest courts, about like you need good hospitals. And the people of Israel had an honest judge, justice system, and an honest chief justice, Solomon, and a wise one to boot. So, ladies and gentlemen, we have finished with 1 Kings 3, verse 28. We see all about Solomon's wisdom. We have seen that. We're now ready to go to 1 Kings 4, verses 1 through 34, and we will look at Solomon's wealth and his wisdom. See you next time. Hope you enjoyed this audio.